The stone I'm chained to. It's loose. I can feel the draft. I've done it.
What?
Taking an aspirin. I don't want to catch cold. Wait. The stone I'm chained to. It's loose.
Really?
Yes. I can feel a draft. Done it.
What?
Taking an aspirin. I didn't want to catch cold.
Hello and welcome to Ye Goon Pod. My name is Little Tyler, unfortunately, and this week we've got a real Robin Hood themed episode. And joining me, looking splendid in a period Lincoln Green shell suit, is returning guest, actor, performer, playwright, Chaz Early. Hello, Chaz.
Hello, Tyler. And you didn't mention my super close-fitting Lincoln Green tights, which I have on underneath.
Underneath the shell suit.
Yes, which I shall be slapping on a regular basis.
Great. Chaz, thank you for coming back to the show.
Thank you.
And you last were on talking about insurance, the white man's burden. I know that we spoke at the beginning about the Bill Hicks show that you performed. And
yeah.
We've talked about that. Now, one thing we didn't talk about that I was... on a plane earlier this week, and had a lot of time to sit and contemplate and think about things. And I was reading as well. I was reading a book that was about terrible British films. Now you've written a book about Keith Moon, haven't you?
I thought you were going to say I've written a terrible British film. I've written a play about Keith Moon.
You've written a play about Keith Moon?
Yeah, not a book, unfortunately.
Oh, right, okay.
I mean, it's been done. The definitive book's sort of been done.
Right. Okay, because the only reason I mention it was that I found out, if this book that I was reading is to be believed, Keith was slated to play Yellowbeard.
Yes.
In the film that obviously came out, 5 years after his death. And Sam Peckinpah was supposed to be on board to direct it. Do you know about this?
I didn't know that latter fact. He was definitely connected to it.
Yeah.
They definitely wanted him to do it, and they'd been in long conversations. I mean, he was very friendly with the Pythons, I know.
Yeah.
So yes, I knew that he'd been talking to them certainly not long before his death about that.
Mm-hmm.
Sam Peckinpah, that would have been interesting though. would have upped the gore content, no doubt.
Yeah, and more graphic rape. Because that's my memory of the film is that it's just endless rape gags. Which
oh god, yes, go. Straw Yellowbeard.
So yeah. the Keith Moon play then.
Yes.
Did you write and appear in it or?
I did. Yes, I played Keith. I mean,
brilliant.
This was similar sort of era to the Bill Hicks show, and it was an Edinburgh. Sadly, it was an Edinburgh only show. We did try and. Do something with it afterwards, but I think the cost and logistics of it, also it's a little bit less of a surefire box office success than Bill Hicks was at that time, so
yeah,
it never went any further, but it did okay at Edinburgh, washed its face, as they say, and I had a lot of fun doing it, and a comedian called Gordon Southern, dear friend of mine, played various roles in it, including Neil Boland, who was Keith's ill-fated driver and kind of lackey for a while.
Yeah.
So it was I had a smashing time doing it, and loved pretending to be Keith. Was in a sort of a woolly white coat and me underpants for quite a lot of the performance. So you know, my natural state. And
Yes.
so yeah, that was a lot of fun, but that was as far as that one went, unfortunately.
Okay. So you've come on today to talk about actually two Goon shows, both linked in that they're centered around the character of Robin Hood, of course.
Yes, indeed.
Ye Bandit of Sherwood Forest from series 5 and Robin Hood from series 7.
Indeed.
So why these particular shows?
Well, Robin Hood and his Merry Mon, as it's announced by Wallace, was another show I heard very early on, because I bought myself, I think, or had bought for me. If you remember when I was talking about Insurance for White Man's Burden, I discovered that and Six Charlies in Search of an Author on Goon But Not Forgotten, which was in my dad's collection. So around the sort of same sort of time, maybe a little bit earlier, maybe that was a little bit earlier, but around the same sort of time, I was buying more Goon records or going to the library and borrowing them. And somebody got me the reissue of the album First Men on the Goon,
Oh,
which
yeah.
is, I think, was originally released in 1971 and it was re-released in 79. So I got a copy of that, and that has this Robin Hood and his Merry Mon, which was never broadcast, hadn't been broadcast at that time in the UK. And I think Fooled by President Fred is on the other side,
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
which is another great show, another fantastic show. And I really enjoy Robin Hood. I think it's got some fantastic gags. I think it's got some really sharp performances, some very interesting guest performances, and it's sort of, in the way that people talk about how Dishonored Again is that much better than Dishonored, and the third version of The Man Who Never Was
Yeah.
is probably the definitive
Yeah.
version. I feel like this is the third time the Goons did a Robin Hood story, and although the first one doesn't actually exist as a recording, you can read the script. That was from series 3, and this one does feel to me like it's the definitive version. I actually came to Robin Hood first, and then had to backtrack and hear Ye Bandit of Sherwood Forest quite a lot later, actually.
Yeah, I can't remember the order I heard them in. I'm much more familiar with Robin Hood, and I guess yeah, because it was on a tape, and I came to Ye Bandit of Sherwood Forest sometime later. And absolutely, I think Robin Hood is the stronger show, and obviously we do not we can't comment on the Series 3 version, the Christmas pantomime. But I've read the script. There's a few good lines in it. Again, before we start talking in general, in terms of Robin Hood, the character, it's do you have, aside from these Goon shows, do you have is there a particular portrayal of Robin Hood on screen that is a favorite of yours?
Well, Disney's probably. It's the one I saw first. It's the one that okay, he's a fox, but it's the one I saw first. It's the one that probably stuck with me the longest. I mean, I've staggered my way through most of the film versions. I haven't seen Robin and Marian, but that's a bit of a different thing. And I haven't seen the Russell Crowe version, but I've seen a lot of other versions, and so I have a vague, I have an understanding of the story as Hollywood or as British movie makers tell it. I'm not sure. I mean, obviously these tend to play slightly fast and loose with the truth, or the truth in terms of the actual historical truth. Obviously Robin is only very vaguely based on historical fact, but the truth of the history around it, King Richard and King John, etc. Probably I'm a lot closer to these and the Disney version than I am to anything approaching the, in inverted commas, real story.
Yeah, because I grew up watching Robin of Sherwood on
Of
TV,
course, yes, that too.
which I don't know how faithful that is to the legend, because I'm no Robin Hood expert, but it felt to me like the Robin Hood equivalent of the Granada Sherlock Holmes series, just in terms of kind of sticking closely to did the original story or stories or whatever.
Yeah, and I think using it as a bit of a launch pad to then sort of go off a little bit, you know, sticking very closely to what we think we know about those characters, and then sort of maybe coming up with some new stories within that.
Yeah, I've never seen Men in Tights. I've never seen Kevin Costner in what's it called, Prince of Thieves.
Prince of Thieves. Yeah, I mean, yeah, really memorable only for Alan Rickman, of course. Yeah,
there's one comedy Robin Hood, I think. And in fact, while I think about it, wasn't, you know, the Blackadder Back and Forth, wasn't, didn't Rick Mayall turn up in that as Robin Hood? Or am I wrong in that?
Oh, I don't know.
I think he may have done. I'll have to check. If he did, I'm keeping this in. If he didn't, I'm cutting it out. but there's one comedy Robin Hood, not from the Goons, that sticks in my head. And it's a cameo. It's John Cleese in Time Bandits.
Yeah, that's a nice little, that's Cleese really just doing himself, isn't it? But yeah. doing it very nicely. Yeah.
Morning, you're all robbers.
Oh, the best, Mr. Hood.
Jolly good, and you're a robber, are you? Jolly good. And do you enjoy robbing then?
Well, it helps pay the rent, sir.
Ha, 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 jolly good. Ha, ha, ha. And you're a robber too, are you? How long have you been a robber?
4'1".
Good Lord. Jolly good. 4'1".
Yes.
Well, that is a long time, isn't it?
Just a very quick bit of housekeeping before we crack on. Listeners who listened to last week's show, which was the episode on the LP Milligan Preserved with myself and Jason Krupa, we were talking about one of the sketches on that album called Another Lot, which is basically Spike in an auction house just reading an increasingly bizarre series of lots in an auction. Yeah. And the music...
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, well, the music that he's talking... There's like a musical track playing behind Spike, which was specially composed by George Martin. And it's a beautiful piece of music. And... It would appear that it's not available in isolation. So it's you know, you can't properly listen to it because you've got Spike sort of droning on over it. And a couple of listeners had said, or a couple of people have said to me, that they'd love, you know, using AI or someone to use AI technology to maybe try and somehow capture the original music without Spike. All right. And Jason, amazingly, went away and had a bit of a tinker. And he's managed to come up. It's not. And he'd be the first to say it's not 100% perfect. But he's basically stripped away Spike, and you can hear the actual tune. And I'll play a little clip of it now. So, yeah, so a beautiful little piece of music there, obviously written by George Martin, composed by George Martin. It's just an example of, you know, his musical genius as well.
Yeah. And amazing how many links there are between the Beatles and the Goons.
Oh, did a whole show on it.
Yeah, I haven't actually listened to it, but I saw that you'd done it, and it is, yeah, I'm sure there was more than enough for you to talk about on that.
Well, do you know what? You've given me the perfect segue, or the perfect link to start talking about Ye Bandit of Sherwood Forest. Okay. Charlotte Mitchell. So Charlotte Mitchell is a guest artiste in Ye Bandit of Sherwood Forest. She's one of the very, very few actresses or female performers to appear in the Goon Show. Around this time, 1954, she was married to an actor called Philip Gard.
Yep.
I'm going somewhere with this, Chaz, okay?
I know you are. I can sense where you're going with it.
She was married to Philip Gard, and I gather they divorced or separated a few years later. Anyway, fast forward to 1967. Mm-hmm. And I Am the Walrus. And okay. at the playout of I Am the Walrus, you remember there's the sound of the tuning of radio.
Yes. Sit and you down, Father. Rest.
Yes.
You.
Now, do you know who that, or one of those two actors?
You're going to tell me one of them. It's one of the guards.
It's Philip Gard.
There you go.
Mr. Charlotte Mitchell.
Good Lord. And that is a really niche link.
Yeah.
From not only from this show, but just from the Goon Show generally to the Beatles. But yeah.
Very briefly, I'll just talk about, so this episode is from series 5, it's episode 14, broadcast 28th of December 1954. Written, it's credited as Spike, written by Spike and Eric Sykes, but I think it's chiefly Spike, really. And we'll talk about the sort of the authorship of these shortly. I just want to briefly just talk about what was going on in terms of the Goons around this time.
Mm-hmm.
On Christmas Day that year, so a few days before this was broadcast, Harry was on a wonderful sounding show called Television's Christmas Party.
Harry Corbett and Sooty.
Harry Corbett and Sooty, that's right, yeah. Peter Sellers was on the Ted Ray Christmas Time show on the home service on mm-hmm. Boxing Day with Kenneth Connor, among others. And at the same time as all this was going on, Seacombe was appearing in Cinderella at the Hippodrome in Coventry, and Sellers was in Mother Goose at the London Palladium.
Which is a pretty big deal, really.
Yeah, so they were really, really busy. Yeah. And, yeah, so, I mean, I said Spike and Eric are down as script writers, but I think it's a reworking, partly, of the Series 3 45-minute Christmas pantomime, just called Robin Hood. Which, as you say, that no longer exists. One day it may turn up. Let's hope so. But that went out on the 26th of December 1952. Now it was recorded while Milligan was in hospital, having had his breakdown, and it has Dick Emery as himself, and I think, looking at the script, Robin Hood as well.
Yes.
And Carol Carr as Maid Marian. Now Carol Carr had appeared earlier that year with the Goons in Down Among the Zed Men. What do you think of that film?
It's interesting. It's a little bit messy. And again, I think they're all finding their feet somewhat as performers. None of them are particularly comfortable yet with the medium of film.
Mm.
You've got Peter doing a sort of a slightly toned down version of Blood Knock. Although actually it may not have been toned down because at that time that might have been exactly what Blood Knock was like in the scripts, but on the radio. And Spike basically doing Eccles, playing a bit of trumpet, and Harry being Harry, really. It's got Benteen doing his chairback routine, which is it's worth it just for that, really. And that is a real tour de force in that particular film. That the film itself is pretty darn slight, but it's entertaining. It's certainly of interest to Goon fans if they haven't already seen it. They should.
But it's also got their former announcer on the Goon Show, Andrew Timothy.
Yeah.
As a Spiv.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, I'd forgotten all about that.
With Graham Stark, who's never more than 6 feet away from Peter Sellers.
But what's interesting about that script, Spike was in hospital, and there's stuff in the Roger Wilmot book, The Goon Show Companion, about this was largely written by Jimmy Grafton, working 36 hours continuously because Spike was hospitalised and Larry Stevens was also ill. And what I find interesting, and I think you might have a different point of view, I don't know, but there's actually quite a lot, large chunks of that 1952 Series 3 version find their way into Ye Bandit. And I find that very interesting because obviously Ye Bandit is credited to, as you say, to Spike and Eric, which makes me feel like really the only bits Jimmy Grafton could have done. There's a couple of in-show songs. I don't mean songs that are kind of like Max Geldre and Ray Ellington.
Yeah.
Songs that, like in a, like you'd have in a panto, with the performers singing them. And I think they probably used music with just new lyrics that Jimmy Grafton had written for them. Mm-hmm. And I know he used to do that for Derek Roy.
Mm.
So I wonder if that was his main contribution to that, and kind of maybe fleshing it out, because quite large chunks of that script have gone into Ye Bandit. And of course, there's no credit for Jimmy Grafton there. So I can only assume that Spike had started writing this either before Spike was hospitalized, or maybe just after. Maybe Spike had been working on it. I know he wasn't performing at the time, but he did start writing again after.
Yeah.
Not very long, I think, after his hospitalization. So.
Yeah.
But it's interesting.
It's one of those knotty problems that we'll never probably ever get an answer to.
We won't know.
Yeah, if you think about it, because you mentioned Dishonored Again.
Mm.
The Dishonored Again in Series 9 is Spike is credited as writer.
Yeah.
But Dishonored Series 5, Eric gets a co-credit.
Yeah, absolutely. And I suppose, you know, there is that Lennon McCartney thing, isn't there, in Series 5, where one of them wrote the vast majority of it and the other one kind of just chipped in a few bits and pieces. And maybe that's the way Spike rationalised that Dishonored was one of his, in inverted commas, shows.
Yeah.
But yeah, again, yeah, it shows it wasn't beyond, they weren't beyond that.
Yeah.
I don't know if that would be a decision that Spike would have made or the relevant producer would have made at the time. But it's interesting.
Because I know that Farrog was recorded the same night as Ye Bandit. I'm sure you've heard that, have you?
Of course, yep.
Yep. And I think that was heavily Eric written.
Right.
If memory serves, a chunk of the bit in the bit with the statues that come to life.
Yes.
I believe that was taken from an episode of Educating Archie that Eric had earlier written.
Ah, that's interesting. It's a really not very Spike conceit, that.
Yeah.
You could understand talking statues, but the them kind of coming to life and walking about, that's more of a, that doesn't feel very Spike. So that's interesting that it's something that that Eric's recycled from a previous script kind of thing, or an idea
I'd looked at the Radio Times listing for Ye Bandit of Sherwood Forest, and someone's taken quite a bit of time, possibly Spike. Did you look at the listing?
I did. I can't remember what they said, but it's one of them's the front of a pantomime horse and one of them's the back of a pantomime horse or something like that. Or maybe that's a different one, but they're very comedic anyway, and they're in keeping with the tone of the show, at least.
Yes, it's you're thinking of the series 3 Robin Hood has Peter Sellers listed as the front legs of Richard Coeur de Lion's horse. Oh, yeah. And Harry Seacom as the back legs. But the Radio Times for Ye Bandit is listed as Ye Goon Show.
Oh, that's right.
And the synopsis is in Ye Year of Grace, Mary and Uncle Fred, 1190, Wallace Greenslade, an itinerant announcer, was bound for Nottingham when Ye Coach was stopped in Sherwood Forest by Robin Hood, who did persuade him to join his band as second sacrobatist and part-time dustman. Greenslade did don Lincoln Green and did assist ye outlaws in their reckless adventures. And there's lots of unnecessary E's at the end of words.
Yes, of course.
Things like that. Cast listing, Coachman Clod Crott, Harry Seacom, Ostler Bowser, Peter Sellers, Wayfarer Bannister, Spike Milligan, Hereward Splutzenheimer, Max Geldre, Robin Hood, Peter Sellers, Will Eccles, Spike Milligan, well, that's correct, Ned Seagoon, Harry Seacom, Friar Crun, Peter Sellers.
Well, you said about Clodcrot, and what's interesting is that in the Robin Hood, I mean, that whole opening sequence, which isn't in the Series 7 Robin Hood, about the sort of the Doncaster setting up, getting into the coach.
Yeah.
You know, the journey's taken by the sheriff in this particular case, played, which is Gripped by Thin, obviously, Peter. And in the original one, it's actually Andrew Timothy who takes the coach ride, and Claude Croft, or the coachman, is played by, I think he's played by Peter in that, and in this one, he's played by Harry. And I don't think it's a character that Claude Croft is definitely a character name that I don't ever remember coming across before.
No.
And I don't even know if it's, I mean, I'm sure Harry did play a yokel at other points during the Goon Show, but it's interesting that it warranted a name. I thought that he even got a name. You know, you'd have just thought Harry brackets yokel would have been enough. But there we go.
Now then, I wish a seat with me back to the horses.
Don't matter where you sit. If you're downwind, you'll still cop it.
Yeah, you're good, joke. Now belt up, will you?
I mean, it all feels like, that section all feels like a bit of a setup, really. It's just to get them into the coach and to set up the fact that you know, Robin's going to sort of highway stop the coach. But there's some nice little gags in there, and I do love that. You know, there's a very old gag which I think Spike had probably used in Hip Hip Hooray, which is, you know, Eccles going sooth, 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 sooth. Mm. Why do you keep saying sooth? Because I'm a soothsayer. Mm. You know, it's, mm-hmm. and it's brilliant, classic little one-liners. He can't resist throwing a few of those in.
But you're right. That is a corny old gag that you would expect from a second rate or third rate.
Yeah, it's a proper panto gag, really. Yeah.
That's a point as well, because this and, well, the Series 3 show and the series 7, Robin Hood, they are designed as pantomime. So in which you've not got Sellers, Seagram, and Milligan. You've got the characters they play playing these characters. Yes.
Yeah, interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's been talked about quite a bit. That, you know, the characters sort of, they're kind of in brackets, if you like. It's like the characters know that they're playing in the world of the Goons. The characters know that they're playing characters. There's almost a sort of meta awareness that they're playing these extra characters. Not so much the Sheriff of Nottingham, I think. I mean, he is Grippipe, and sort of Grippipe doesn't really sneak through into the Sheriff of Nottingham. It's just sort of the same style of character and the same voice. And that's interesting to me as well, because for me, this might be at the actual crux of why, for me, Ye Bandit isn't as good as, well, it's one of the reasons, at least, why Ye Bandit isn't as good as the Series 7 Robin Hood, because I don't think Grippipe really works as the sheriff. He's a little bit too laid back and a little bit too louche to play kind of a sort of, you know, a real villain. And I think I know he is a villain, but he's a different type of villain. It's almost too straight for the character. The part is almost too straight for the character of.
He's not down at heel.
No,
as Grippipe tends to be.
No, and he's not really a schemer either. He's suave, and he's obviously a little bit bad. And I think that was the absolute genius of casting Valentine Dial as the sheriff in Robin Hood, because he's got the gravitas and that kind of, you know, he can play dastardly, and has obviously got the voice for that as well. But he's also very funny. He delivers the lines really, really well. But it's you know, Grippipe's a wholly different character in that show, and it's you know, I think it works that much the better for it.
Yeah, by that point, his relationship with Moriarty was entrenched.
Yes.
At this point in Series 5, very often Moriarty and Grippipe wouldn't be connected at all.
Or
occasionally in any case.
And in fact, Moriarty's not even in the show at all, is he?
No,
He's not in Ye Bandit at all.
No.
So,
And I find, and I'd like to just come on to Charlotte Mitchell. I find her quite grating in this.
And so the
dynamic between her and the sheriff just doesn't work.
No, because the sheriff's almost too camp and sort of a bit too suave, and she is such a sort of silly posh girl. I mean, to be fair to her, I think she's taken, depending on who you read, she's either magnificent and right up to speed with the goons, or she's an absolute disaster. And I'm sort of somewhere in between. She was obviously told to play it completely, sort of absolutely cut glass. English maiden, English rose.
Mm.
It's almost sort of like regal, her accent.
Yes.
And I think that, I mean, she clearly could do comedy. She did quite a lot of comedy around that time. Obviously, she met Peter and thereby presumably got this gig doing And So to Bentley on television, which was a Muir and Norden scripted show. So she could, she had an affinity for it, but she's a straight woman. And I think she is given too many gag lines to do here. And her delivery of them, it's fine. It just could be, I just think it could be sharper. And when you see, so for example, the scene that she does in the cell with, the scene that where Maid Marian is in the cell with Robin Hood.
Yeah.
And they're trying to escape from that cell or get through to the next cell. That's reproduced almost exactly with Robin Hood and Bloodknock in as Friar Balsam.
That's right.
In Robin Hood in series 7. And it's so much better.
Yes.
It's so much better in that show because obviously, you know, Sellers and Seacombe are so much more in tune with not only with each other, but also with the show, you know, with the style of the show and the pacing of it. Would have had probably had more rehearsal as well, to be fair. Mm-hmm. So, it makes a massive difference.
That's a good point, actually, because there was two shows recorded. As I said, there was this and Fogg.
Mm.
And whenever there's two shows recorded, particularly during Series 8, when they were doing the Vintage Goons alternate weeks, I think a bit of tiredness or weariness crept in, perhaps, to the performances. So they were kind of going through the motions to a degree. So Charlotte Mitchell, we talked about her on, because she was also in, and she was much better in the episode Tales of Montmartre.
Agreed.
And it's fairly widely accepted now that she was having a thing with Peter Sellers at the time.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, they were both married. Not that I ever would have stopped Peter. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Could it have been, do you think, I mean, Spike said, didn't he, somewhere that, Peter was having a thing with her.
Yes.
But he called her Charlotte Mitchell. He called her a different name. When he quoted, he was talking about the women who'd been in the show, and he called her Charlotte somebody else. I can't remember what the surname was. He got her name wrong.
Yeah.
And he said, Sellers was having a thing with her at the time. But I don't know. Do you have any other sources for that being a thing?
I don't really. I've just read it in multiple.
Yeah.
Roger Lewis mentions it, but that's no guarantee.
No, absolutely. I just wonder if it might have been more that Peter had met her on the show and really fancied her and said, oh, why don't you come and do a goon show? I'm sure you could do a goon show with us as well, and sort of got her on in the hope that he might be able to sort of weasel his way into her affections. I mean, it's not beyond the bounds of possibility, obviously. Given that she was only a few years into her marriage at that time.
Yeah.
I do wonder if it isn't just sort of some scurrilous rumours. However, you have to wonder why she, and not someone, let's say, like June Whitfield, wasn't asked to do the show, who I think would have done it with much more aplomb.
Yeah, yeah.
And obviously they must have known her. They must have known. The goon guys must have worked with her, done stuff with her.
I guess, I mean, in interviews over the years, because obviously she went on to become more famous. Her most famous role was in The Adventures of Black Beauty in the 70s. Mm. And whenever she's interviewed around that period, she mentions the goons, and she always tends to sort of talk about them as a group as being all friends with her. So she never singles out Sellers particularly,
no.
You know.
No, no.
She did say in an interview, kind of echoing Kenneth Williams from Just a Minute here slightly, they shouldn't have had women on the show, she said. she said, they did it best themselves. I was all right in the Montmartre show because somehow it worked. But in Robin Hood, I was much too slow. I didn't have their pace and I was a bit nervous in front of the audience. No kidding.
You can tell. I mean, you really can. She's, some of the delivery is a little bit heavy-handed. I think she's okay. She obviously largely understands the gag. I don't think there's any point where you think she hasn't understood that. It's just she's not naturally, you know, she's not as natural a comic performer as the guys. So, you know, and, you know, that was their bread and butter. It was their daily bread, and it wasn't hers. So you can't really blame her for that.
Sheriff of Nottingham, take your hands off me. If they're not off in the next 3 hours, I'll write to the police.
Little spitfire.
Oh, fie. You see, my fiancé, Mr. R. Hood, will come and fisticuff you. He'll hit thee. Splat, thun, blat, zowie, socko, blam, thud, biff. He learned all his boxing from comic strips. Have you ever seen a comic strip?
Only in a Turkish bath.
I don't wish to knowest that.
In that case, goodbyest.
I'm there's a bit of me that thinks if you have to have a female Maid Marian, and of course you didn't have one, you don't have one in the Series 7 Robin Hood at all. But if you've got to have one, you know, Sellers might have done a very good job of it as well with his breathy Kensington Deer voice.
Yeah, or a variation of Crystal Jollybottom even.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
See, I overthink things, right? And I said to you before we started recording, I was re-listening to these shows while away on the weekend.
Mm.
And I wrote this down because right when Charlotte Mitchell's, when Maid Marian first appears in the show, she says, Sheriff of Nottingham, take your hands off me. If they're not off in the next 3 hours, and it sounds like she's sort of stumbled,
yeah,
I'll write to the police. Okay.
Yes.
And I wrote that down saying, oh, that just sounds like she stumbled there, and, you know, they could have done a retake or whatever, you know. But then I thought, actually, is that how she was told to do it? Because, you know, the gag is if they're, yes, not off in the next 3 hours.
Yes.
People.
Quite possibly she might have been, she might have been directed that way.
Yeah.
And it's the same with, she says, he learned all his boxing from comic strips. Have you ever seen a comic strip? And of course, with that emphasis, rather than saying a comic strip, with that emphasis, you set up the gag,
yes,
only in a Turkish bath, that much better, really. But actually, it sort of jars. Whereas when you hear that gag in the in Robin Hood, I mean, unfortunately, Dedis Price slightly cocks up the response to it in Robin Hood Series 7. But, I think it's Blue Bot, isn't it? Have you ever seen a comic strip only in a Turkish bath? So I think that relies on the fact that people will pick up on the gag, even if they pick up on it a little bit late, rather than sort of really signposting it hugely, writing a big kind of, you know, double underline underneath the words comic strip to show that there's a, you know, there's a double meaning. And so, yeah, there's a lot of that with her. And it's all done at a similar pitch as well. So it's all sort of, and it's that makes it sort of, and again, I'm sure that's what she was told to do, but it makes it hard to love. And I don't think that's entirely down. I don't think that's about her being bad. As I say, I think that's probably what she was told to do. She was told to be this frightfully nice, ridiculously strangulated accent English rose, you know.
I mean, Irene Handel would have done a better job of it.
Yeah.
Irene Handel doing a dry weight Wayne accent.
Exactly, yes. And, no, dear, no. We found him in a room with a net. That thing, yeah. I mean, oh, God, shit, I love her and she would have been great.
Yeah.
There's one interesting little bit in that whole section that there's only about two jokes, I think, that find, as far as I could tell, that make their way through all three iterations. So the Series 3, Ye Bandit in Series 5, and Robin Hood in Series 7. And one of them is trying to pull out the stone, the loose stone in the cell. I'm pulling it out. I've done it. What? Taking an aspirin. I don't want to catch cold.
Yep.
And again, it's a good little gag. And when I first heard it in Robin Hood, I laughed at it. I'm not sure it was strong enough to really get across all three.
No. Yep.
And the only other one I think, and I'm sorry if I'm rushing ahead here, but is when they come across Eccles in the cell, when they discover that Eccles is in the cell with them. Eccles, what are you doing in here? 6 months, what are you doing? Which I think is a fantastic gag, to be fair. That is worthy of keeping in. Again, I mean, it's a nice, easy one, but it's one that I love. So I'm very glad to get that one.
Well, the coach ride, isn't the coach ride common in all three as well?
Yeah, it does. I don't know about the individual gags there is. Or there's a really interesting thing in the coach ride is that I don't quite understand in Ye Bandit why it's Friar Balsam that first of all holds up.
Mm.
It's Friar Balsam that holds up the coach. And then he sort of introduces it. I think it's only because to set up this sort of very silly introduction of Robin Hood played by Neddy. Where he sort of makes all these noise about, you know, sings and jumps up and down and says, "Mort, there we are, Mort, thank you, come on, Mort."
Yeah.
And then weirdly, the sheriff says, "Come along, Robin, there's no need to be so shy." Robin, this is our new recruit. And I think, and I guess someone else has pointed out somewhere that really, I think that was Sellers getting the voice wrong. That should have been... Because it didn't make any sense for the sheriff to say.
Oh, yes.
Doesn't make any sense for the sheriff to say, Robin, this is our new recruit. Because he's not part of the gang, is he?
That's very true.
It should have been Friar Balsam. So, I strongly suspect that was Mr. Sellers just getting the wrong voice.
He's done it before.
Well, he has. And, you know, you can't really blame him, given all the different parts he was playing all the time.
Seagoon, alias Handsome Harry, plus Harry Seagoon, now playing in pantomime. Be my love, or known as falling in love with love is falling. Recall in armory, liberates rivers array. Well done, more. There we are, more, thank you, more.
Come along, Robin, there's no need to be so shy. Robin, this is our new recruit.
Welcome to the band. I'll have you fitted for a suit of Lincoln green. Call Nonny the tailor.
Yes, what is it, Dumpling?
And he then changes voice swiftly to his off-the-peg Jewish character.
Yeah. And he's, he's kind of... That's an interesting thing as well. I mean, that sort of... I think he Robin... Or you know, the money, the ransom money to get him out of the cell later on, is all, I think maybe in all three shows is a Jewish character, but although here he's obviously very East London Jewish.
Mm.
And he's he's a tailor and all this kind of thing.
Mm.
And then weirdly in Robin Hood in Series 7, he's morphed into a New York Jew called Norris. And he calls him Lou at the end of it as well. He says, Lou's let down Milligan. Lou let down Milligan at Eastbourne.
It's no good. Lou is unreliable. He let Milligan down at Eastbourne.
I know.
So obviously that, I don't know if that's a kind of Lou Grade reference.
It is. It is. And I want to credit actually Sean Gaffney. I think it was Sean that came up with this explanation. If it's not you, Sean, take the credit anyway. So you've got the Lou voice, and then. Is it Harry says he let Milligan down at Eastbourne?
Mm.
And yeah, it refers to Lou Grade himself, who had been, Spike had been on the doing some gigs, and he said he'd pay Spike extra if a gig went really well. And then when a gig did go really well, he didn't pay him.
Right.
And supposedly Spike, every year after that, sent him a Christmas card reminding him that he hadn't been paid.
How very typically Spike.
Yes. And we'll briefly come back to Luke Grade in a bit, I think. You know, you mentioned the comic strips as well.
Mm.
What do you make of the fight scenes with the biff, thud, blam?
Yeah, it's interesting that they didn't occur in the series three section. I wonder if that might have been an Eric thing. I mean, to start off, it's presumably just a gag. You know, there was a gag about when's the blasted sound effects person going to turn up.
Mm.
So it was to fit in with that gag. But there's a lot of stuff around the fifth series about, I think around that time, about Bluebottle being into horror comics. And obviously they were just sort of that kind of American style, you know, superhero and, you know, occasionally war.
Yeah.
Illustrated war comics were presumably, you know, were being read by British youth.
Yes.
By this time, maybe they were just sort of permeating at this time, and maybe they were something that was kind of that was growing in popularity, and therefore were a bit more topical by the end of 1954.
Yeah, because obviously you associate all these weird words that they use, like blin at one point, which is a word actually referenced by Spike. So they use it during the Robin Hood episode, Series 7, and Spike's referenced Blin a few months earlier in an interview where he talked about a pop single he was writing called Do the Blin, which he never, as far as I know, was never released. But it made me think of, it obviously made me think of 60s Batman for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But it made me think, you know, what was the state of comics in Britain at that time in terms of representations of fights in comics, yeah, where, you know, words like pow and thud and splat, yeah, and whatever. And I asked a friend of mine, Tilt, who knows about these things, and he just said that he looked at the handful of British comics from the 50s. He said such scenes are not very prevalent. He found a few in Suspense magazine from 1953, but he thinks that they might be reprints of US strips. And he said in Radio Fun, you do get that sort of those sort of sound effects, if you like.
Okay. Yeah.
But mainly in comedy strips, not so much, you know, not in superhero or horror strips or anything like that. And he actually shared a comic strip from 1960. I think it's from Radio Fun, and it's actually about three characters called Bam, Splat, and Bluey. So yeah, it's obviously, you know, Spike and or Eric have picked up on these, and just decided it would be funny to include them in Ye Bandit, and decided to continue it when they came to, or when Spike and Larry came to write Robin Hood.
It's a slightly different way of presenting a kind of slightly comedic fight as well, isn't it? Rather than just sort of comedy sound effects, which obviously would have been what they normally would have done.
Yeah.
So maybe there's that as well. But I mean, you know, a lot of it, I think, is Spike just reveling in silly words for the sake of silly words, which I can get right behind.
Yeah.
You know, splat, thun, zowie, blun, thud, biff, clud, splam, blat, socko. I love all that. So I'm a sucker for that sort of stuff. So it may just, that may just have been it.
And I'm straying very nearly into the area of overthinking things. I mentioned Luke Grade before.
Mm.
So Ye Bandit comes out late 54.
Mm-hmm.
And in September 1955 on ATV, The Adventures of Robin Hood, starring Richard Greene, begins, which had been commissioned by Lew Grade. And obviously, so sandwiched in between Ye Bandit and Robin Hood in 56, you get the beginning of The Adventures of Robin Hood, which was incredibly popular.
Yes, indeed. And that's why, of course, you get the song at the end of...
Yes.
You know, as they go off, as they exeunt at the end of Series 7, Robin Hood, they're all singing the theme to the TV series. So, yes. So they obviously picked up on that as well.
Yeah, yeah. There's a couple of topical gags in Ye Bandit. One which I know we've touched on in this show. I think it's possibly in the episode we did on the case of the missing heir, because there's Peter Sellers enjoys for a couple of shows imitating Winston Churchill looking for a blasted telegram.
Yeah, it was early in December 54, apparently. Churchill had said in a speech that he'd sent a telegram to Monty, Field Marshal Montgomery, at the end of the war, telling him to sort of stockpile any German weaponry that he captured, that he'd sort of taken in at the end of the war, to be ready to give back to German soldiers in case of a Russian invasion. So this was all sort of, I don't know why something that was mentioned in a constituency speech. I mean, obviously, you know, he was prime minister, so people would have been paying attention, but why that in particular was sort of leapt upon by media, presumably other people presumably other MPs.
Yeah.
So, because I think there was a furor because they said they wondered why Monty hadn't, you know, I think there was some inference about Monty not having done what he was asked. And so he went to look for the telegram in his papers and couldn't find it and said he didn't recall such a telegram. And Churchill in the end backed down and said, I'm sorry, I'm confused. I was thinking of a different telegram and I hadn't sent, it was just something, you know, I got mixed up. And he was coming up to 80 at that point, wasn't he? So I don't know if that was sort of possibly part of his excuse that maybe, you know, his memory wasn't quite as good as it was, which is never good to hear when you're a prime minister. But he's, so that looking for the blasted telegram became a bit of a running gag, and it was in a few of the shows, and it's in Farrog as well.
Yeah.
And of course it became a bone of contention and apparently was one of the reasons why Sellers was supposedly banned from doing an impersonation of Churchill.
But Sellers said to a journalist, I'm sure with a certain amount of artifice maybe here, Sellers said, while I know that there is a technical ban on imitating senior statesmen, I have done this for months without complaint. I've never been at all derogatory, and I know from a very good authority that Sir Winston has heard this imitation himself and raised no objection. So Churchill's a keen listener to the Goon Show around this time.
Yeah, well, it could well have been. They probably would have learned the lesson not to mention the telegram gag again. I don't remember there were many more times of him doing Churchill on the show, but
he did Churchill in the film The Man Who Never Was, didn't
yes,
he?
Yes, I know. Yeah, of course. I always thought his was sort of almost a bit too. I'll just say a bit too boozy, but of course Churchill was pretty darn boozy. So, you know, even when he was working. So maybe I'm doing Peter a disservice there.
Yeah. You can never completely strip away Sellers' voice from a lot of his impressions.
No, that's true.
Despite the fact that people often say that you completely, you know, it was like hearing a tape recording of your voice being played back to you and that sort of thing, you know.
I mean, he's got an incredible ear, but I do think he's always at the core. You always really know it's him.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, yeah.
So was the other gag the wolves gag?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. So again, this is that's a gag that came out of. Interestingly, this is a gag that was that came out of the series 3 panto. In the script, there, the wolves will get him. You know, don't worry, he's fallen off the coach. I've thrown him off the coach, and the wolves will get him. And the answer at that point in the 52 show is, oh, he'd be so unhappy. He always wanted to play for Manchester United. And in by in 54, just at the beginning of 54, of course, Wolverhampton Wanderers had recently or just beaten the Hungarian champions Honved. And of course, England, the England football team, had a couple of absolutely thumping defeats to the Hungarian national team. So it was a way of, you know, sort of regaining a little bit of prestige.
Yeah. So in this one, see also the whistling spire, Digba.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. Explodable boots. So in this one we get.
Oh dear, 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 no, dear. I must have dozed off. Where are we, pray, gentlemen?
We're in Sherwood Forest, madam. Pity you're not younger.
Oh. Oh dear, what's become of the long, thin lad?
I threw him out of the coach a mile back.
Whatever made you do that, sir?
I don't know, just high spirits, I suppose.
Poor lad. Lost in the forest. The wolves will get him.
Please, don't mention the wolves.
Why not?
I'm a Hungarian.
you know, cue a very, very big laugh. Probably the biggest laugh of the show.
Wolverhampton Wanderers played a match against, as you say, the Hungarians, and Wolves won. And it was on. It was in 13th of December 1954, and it was. And yeah. This is really interesting. It was broadcast on BBC television, or at least the second half was.
Yes,
because in the early days of the BBC broadcasting any sport, they'd often just show half the game because the actual football clubs thought that if the whole match was broadcast, it would stop people actually attending the matches in person.
Absolutely. And I mean, and that was, that continued for years. I mean, the reason that...
I didn't know that. That's amazing.
Match of the Day. So when Match of the Day first came on in 64, they wouldn't announce what games they were going to because they would feel that if people knew the highlights were on, even the highlights were on television in the evening, they wouldn't bother going to the match, which, you know, again, seems pretty darn stupid, but there we are.
Yeah.
But what's also interesting about that game, fact fans, is that Honved were 2-0 up in the first half. So you have to wonder if it's because the cameras were on them. Suddenly Wolves decided they were going to shine and they came back and won 3-2.
Maybe. So, maybe. When we get, so we get Will Eccles, played by Eccles.
Who's great.
He's been thrown out of the coach by the sheriff, and he tells Robin that the sheriff has imprisoned Maid Marian. And it's in the script, there's a mention made of Handsome Harry.
Mm.
And Handsome Harry was regularly referred to in the early Goon shows.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, is Handsome Harry referred to in the Series 3 Robin Hood? Is that a remnant?
I think it might be, you know. I don't have that script
in front of me
right
now.
But I think it might have been, which is odd, isn't it? Because, you know, Adventures of Handsome Harry Seacombe were really kind of only, you know, early series 2 and 3, I think, maybe. It was a very odd little drop-in for series 5, isn't it?
I meant to check and I didn't. So anyway, someone else can go and check if that's the case. Greenslade. Now Greenslade gets, I think this may be the first reference to his fan club, possibly.
Ah, really?
I think so. Yeah,
because he's obviously plays, you know, it's, and they get that in because they know at the end, you know, he's going to be sort of part of the payoff. But Bill plays quite a big part in this one, and he doesn't at all. He's only an announcer in the Series 7 one, which is another interesting choice. And I wonder if that's also a hangover from the fact that Andrew Timothy, plays a huge part in the series 3 one. I mean, like a real character, not way more than an announcer. He's in it all the way through, playing almost like the central character, almost like a Tommy Handley type character from Itmar. So it might be a hangover from that, but it's Bill and his Chickity Snitch and all of that stuff.
Mr. Rhythm Greenslade.
I love, in fact, when he has to do sort of a French or anything like that, I do think he's a really important member of the team. And I like that he gets a few bits. I mean, those are a little bit over the top, those, the Greenslade fan club bits, but, Yeah, it makes for a nice payoff at the end, doesn't it? When Maid Marian runs off with him,
yeah,
instead of Robin.
Yep.
Oh, I skipped to the end, of course, but there we go.
Well, anyway, we're not going following this in a linear fashion. No, there was a strange line, which I don't know. It sounded a bit jarring when the sheriff is talking to Minnie Bannister, yeah. And he says, "Pity you're not younger."
Yeah, I know. That's really quite disturbing, really. yeah. And it's sort of elided over a little bit, I think, in that. And of course, it doesn't come back up in the Series 7 one, and I'm quite glad about that, frankly. Yeah, very strange.
So do you want to look at Robin Hood a bit more detail, definitely. Now? So it was recorded 2nd of December 56, same evening as the episode What's My Line?
Okay, interesting.
Which, yeah, and again, What's My Line doesn't have a great reputation.
No,
amongst fans.
I don't like it. I must admit, you could sort of see why, because they're trying to cram a narrative or a story into the format of a TV quiz show, and it doesn't quite come off. But this is so much better.
So we wonder whether they recorded this one first and then What's My Line after. Yeah.
Well, it's difficult to know because on the one hand, you're right, some fatigue might creep in. On the other hand, with some additions to the cast and, having had a touch of the old Marlon Brando around the back, maybe that would sort of loosen them up a little bit as well. I mean, this is the great thing about this one. I think it gets cracking really quickly. I mean, it starts off with a brilliant thing, which, I love Eccles. Eccles is by far my favourite character. And this is London calling the world, says Bill. And Eccles, hello, world. Mm. And that's just that's a great start. That hooked me in from moment one. But he gets right to the meat of it and right to the kind of, and even has Peter as sort of Cod Olivier.
Yes.
Giving a little historical introductions to what's going on.
It is now Christmas Eve in the year 1191. In distant Acre, my lord, King Richard, Coeur de Lion, does battle in a valiant crusade. But here at home in England's realm, a despotic rump is lowered onto our ancient throne. Its owner is yclept Prince John.
But to the poor people of England, hope is kindled by a magic name. Robin Hood!
Robin Hood!
Robin Hood!
Robin Hood!
And it was specially recorded by Transcription Services for a Christmas episode to be only broadcast to Commonwealth countries.
Yeah, of course.
Canadian CBC primarily, but also, it was obviously sent out to Australia, New Zealand, etc. Mm-hmm. It wasn't broadcast in the UK until much later, Christmas Day 1988.
Yes.
There's an article that in the Radio Times at that, in December 88, quite a lengthy article showcasing the fact that, this never before broadcast Goon Show is going to be broadcast for the first time on the BBC. Mm. And I won't read it all out, of course, but the tone of it is that it's because the 3 years earlier they'd broadcast 1985, which no one had heard since it went out in 55. And the article's kind of implying that nobody's heard Robin Hood, the Goon Show from 1956, since it was recorded. That's the kind of implication. But of course, anyone with a passing interest in the Goons probably heard it because they had it on LP or tape.
Yeah, absolutely.
So which it's a bit disingenuous, really. But anyway.
Yeah, I was a lot less excited about the fact it was going to be on the radio.
The only thing I would say, of course, is that the musical bits are cut out for the
That's
LP.
True. That's true.
So they're reinstated.
Yep.
But it's a much stronger episode than Ye Bandit. And of course, as we've already alluded to, it has two heavyweight guest stars, Valentine Dial and of course Dennis Price.
Yeah.
As Prince John. Valentine Dial is the sheriff and Dennis Price as Prince John. And I've always been a huge admirer of. Although he doesn't have huge range, I would say, Dennis Price. Right. I always love seeing Dennis Price because he turns up in so many things.
Yes. And it's a sort of quite odd range of things as well. So, you know, he'll be playing sort of slightly raffish villains in Kind Hearts and Coronets, and, you know, which is he's excellent in. And then, you know, but then he'll sort of be playing sort of very kind of diffident characters, much less leading man type characters. You know, he did get, I know he got in a sort of in the late 40s and up to the mid 50s, he was getting those sort of, you know, the James Mason, you know, sort of terribly bad, but you can't quite work out why sort of parts. But what I hadn't really grasped up until this point was that his career had been, you know, subsequent to Kind Hearts and Coronets, his career had slightly gone into the doldrums. I mean, this might have been part of the revival, but he was not a happy man around this time.
No, he wasn't. And I think his biggest film, certainly in terms of, you know, he was the leading man, was Kind Hearts and Coronets.
Sure.
But plenty of fantastic supporting roles, School for Scoundrels, Victim, Danger Within, Tunes of Glory, Theatre of Blood, great film, Theatre of Blood, The Rebel, Murdered Most Fell. God, so many of them. A High Wind in Jamaica, even, which I'm really fond of, which is weird, High Wind in Jamaica, because one of the child actors is Martin Amis. Did you know that?
Oh, no. I have to admit to not knowing the film.
Ah, right, okay. Somehow or other, his dad was involved with it, so that's how Martin got that gig.
Sure.
His last film, Dennis Price, I don't know if you've checked this, Chaz. His last film, I'm sure you're familiar with, it's a film that I saw for the first and only time, and it will be the only time I ever see this film, a couple of years ago, Son of Dracula, with Harry Nilsson and Ringo Starr.
Oh, my word, of course. I didn't realise he was in that.
Yeah, and I think he played Van Helsing, and famously, was it Graham Chapman and Douglas Adams were asked to write new dialogue that was going to be dubbed over it because the original dialogue was so dreadful or something?
Yeah, I think I saw this as either late teens or early 20s, and it was sort of at my height of my kind of Beatles obsession, and obviously was a Python fan and all that kind of stuff as well. So that was... Yeah, and I remember it being pretty unwatchable.
Yeah. And he's, Price appears in six films that also feature Sellers. The Naked Truth, which is brilliant. He plays a blackmailer. I'm All Right, Jack. I think he, from memory, he plays the crooked associate of Richard Attenborough's factory owner, I think.
Yeah.
The Millionaires, Wrong Arm of the Law, which has got a very brief role, but brilliant. And Magic Christian and Alice's Adventures in Wonderland.
Good Lord.
And he had a bit of a problem with the bottle, I think, it's fair to say, and a lot of internal demons and things like that.
He'd not been long divorced, I think. Mm. I don't know if that exacerbated the alcohol problem or was the cause of it. And I know he was certainly having a fallow period, and I think you know, it is widely accepted, is it not, that in April of this very year, oh no, sorry, April 1954, sorry, so not of this year, so this is late 56, but in 54 he was found unconscious in his Gasfield flat in Kensington. And although I've seen a newspaper report that from the time, and it doesn't allude to it being anything sort of suspicious, I think it's generally widely accepted that it wasn't an attempted suicide. And actually, it's also widely accepted that, you know, at least part of his revival in fortunes after that was from people rallying around him and from a general sort of, you know, sympathetic reaction to the fact that that happened, which is nice to know, you know, because that wasn't always the case for people with depression and mental illnesses around that time at all. So it shows he had some good friends, and you know, maybe this was a little bit part of that as well.
Yeah, it's. I'm wondering. I'd love to know the rationale behind. I'm wondering whether Sellers had been filming The Naked Truth around this time, perhaps, possibly, because I know that there's an episode. I think it's series 9, first episode. What's it called? Sahara Desert Statue.
Oh yes.
Leo McKern's in the audience.
Oh really?
And around that time, at that time, Sellers was filming The Mouse That Roared with Leo McKern. Right. So you think he probably said to Leo, "Come on, come down to Camden."
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe possibly that's. Yeah. Well, again, Sellers roped in Charlotte Mitchell for Ye Bandit.
Yes.
Did he rope in Dennis Price? Quite possibly. Well,
I think they probably thought to themselves, you know, who can we get to do this? You know, and it would have been whoever they were working with at the time or their close mates, I'm sure. So that makes a lot of sense. I mean, he's a slightly odd choice in that he is, you could imagine Grippipe. I mean, what's interesting is that Grippipe could have been the Sheriff of Nottingham again. Grippipe could have been Prince John, King John.
Mm.
But he ends up playing himself in a kind of, ends up playing himself. Grippipe is just Grippipe in a slightly sort of, he and Moriarty just provide a kind of narrative bridge from the Sheriff and King John into Robin Hood being captured and put in prison. And then they don't appear again after that. Dennis is a little bit of an odd choice. So maybe, as I say, there was something about the fact that, I think he's very good in it. He sort of slightly swallows a couple of gag lines, but I like his sort of slight ineffectual campness. It's a really interesting contrast to Valentine Dial as the Sheriff, who's of course is giving it 110% of in dastardliness. So it's a really nice, it works really well for me, that pairing.
Your Majesty, is it this Robin Hood vagabond that upsets you?
Oh, don't mention that man's name again. Don't mention that man's name to me again.
But what part of him shall I mention then?
Well, there's so much of him.
You insisted on Seacombe playing the part. What? Quiet back there!
Well, I don't...
You're not on to the second act.
My Lord Sheriff Nottingham, I have decided. You will capture that fellow Robin Hood by Christmas, or I'll split your godkin with a leather mackerel sheet.
Oh, Majesty!
Yes, and we need not dwell on Valentine Dial. We've spoken of him many times on this show. His legend precedes him.
Yes, excellent man.
So December, the month that this is recorded, in 1956, You Gotta Go Owl was released.
Yes.
And you wouldn't know it, because Moriarty barely mentions it, does he?
Another record sold.
I love the fact Moriarty's age is actually given here. Because Grippipe says that brown Christmas parcel, madam, is an eccentric French count of some 32 summers.
Yes.
Which by my reckoning means he's a year older than Sellers was in real life. And we've got a kind of slight running gag of this madrigal spikes.
And that's another thing. And there's another couple of little sort of inserts in there that I really love. We've got Spike as this sort of very ho-voiced madrigal singer, sort of doing the links, kind of like being a kind of a chorus.
Yeah.
But which I really like. And of course, he can't quite keep it entirely serious, and at the end of it has to sort of like sheepishly say, oh, that's enough of that.
The snow was gently falling as Robin to Nottingham went. He entered the archery contest with a hat all battered and a bed. Oh, that's enough of that.
But there's also, again, which I think is just a brilliant gag, just such a brilliant gag. He does a town crier character in a sort of Spriggs voice.
Yes.
And it's one of my favourite gags ever in the Goon Show.
Ding dong, clang, clang, ding, ding dong, bang, bang. One bell.
And even comes back later, that character even comes back later for another little joke, you know, another little joke where he does dong, 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 and Segan goes, midnight, dong, 1 o'clock. You know, it's, just those kind of little inserts which aren't in. And that's what I think made Spike so brilliant, those kind of, those sort of really off-kilter little moments that don't really add anything to the, you know, they clearly don't add anything to the plot or the or characterization, but just such a brilliant gag.
That stolen one bell gag is timeless.
It is. It's, I
you
mean,
you could have that in Horrible Histories or anything comparable today.
And his timing of doing it as well is perfect. You know, and Spike was always sort of, you know, played second fiddle to as a performer, or was treated as a lesser performer. But his delivery of that is just excellent. Mm. so that's one of my favourite moments of all in the Goon Show. So another reason why I love this show so much. And then we have the Minnie and Henry in the coach again.
Oh, yeah, because in series three, so we keep jumping back and forth.
No.
Henry's not in series three.
No.
Minnie is.
Yes.
There's just, like you say, there's bits. There's a couple of bits that occur in all three, or sequences, or variations of the same sequence that occur in all three iterations. Each time they're built upon, and like you say, this is Robin Hood is the superior of the three. And,
I mean, apart from anything else, it's just, the casting's dead right. I mean, you know, as I say, Ned Segan isn't even Robin in the first one. It's as you said, it's Dick Emery.
Dick Emery, yeah.
And although he makes it in the set in Ye Bandit, again, you've got Grip Piper as the sheriff, and that doesn't quite work. And you've got Charlotte Mitchell, and she doesn't quite work either. Mm. So I think this time it's, you know, we've got it right. We've actually got it right. We've got a brilliant villain. We've got Neddy playing and doing all the kind of important stuff. You know, Neddy is absolutely the centerpiece of this show, playing Robin. And that's important, I think. You know, obviously all the Goon shows revolve around Ned to an extent, but it's right that he's central in this.
Yeah. I was a little bit confused by, because during the archery, because there's the archery contest in Robin Hood, and
that's odd, isn't it?
Yeah, Robin is disguised as a Kentucky minstrel, which I had to look up, which as the name suggests, Kentucky Minstrels was an early variation of the black and white minstrel show on the radio, which had ended in 1950. It's just an odd, I guess the gag is that, you know, Robin is in blackface in the archery contest. I guess that's it.
Yes, I guess. I mean, it's not something I'd looked into, thought about too deeply. I mean, I know they're in disguise, but yes, I suppose that makes sense, doesn't it? Blackface, you know, do you think they'll recognise me? No. Mm. what I think is funny about this little exchange is that I think it's the sound effect. So he says, watch this for shooting, and fires off an arrow, and you hear a whoosh and a thud, and then you hear a bull. And he says, a bull. But I think it's Harry Secombe doing the sound of the bull. It's certainly not a sound effect. I'm pretty sure it's not a sound effect. If it's recorded, then it's...
I don't think it is either. No.
If it is recorded, it's someone using their voice to impersonate a bull. And I think it is actually Harry Secombe doing it.
I thought it was Spike, but...
It's just such an odd thing to do. I just wonder why they didn't try and kind of get an actual sound effect for it. It's because it's so clearly one of the cast doing it.
Well, they probably said to the Grams guys, what have we got? And they said, well, we haven't got the sound of a bull having been shot by an arrow.
Yeah.
I'll play the clip so listeners can make up their own mind, but I think it's Spike, but it's quite possibly Harry.
A bull!
So Blue Bottle, we mentioned obviously there's no Maid Marian, but Blue Bottle kind of is he the?
It's sort of divided up between Bloodnock and Blue Bottle, isn't it? Because there's the section in the cell, which is Bloodnock.
Yep.
And then all the stuff about that's my fiance during the fight, and that becomes Blue Bottle, doesn't it? My captain. That's my captain did that. And so, her Maid Marian's lines are sort of doled out to a combination of Bloodnock and... I think the section of Bloodnock and Robin in the... Oh, sorry, Friar Balsam and Robin in the cell. It's by far the best. Again, it's such an improvement on the other... other two versions, and the two of them working together are just so much tighter. And there's some great lines as well. And I don't think in any of the other ones, although they all go from one cell to another in all three shows, I think there's a great line that you get. What a relief to get out of that filthy cell 25. Mm-hmm. Now then, where are we? In filthy cell 26. Yeah. You know, they've not escaped, they've just gone into the next cell. And
yes.
I think it's the only one that actually, it's the only show that actually underlines that by making the gag.
Yes.
But I mean, it does work so nicely, the whole Friar Balsam and Robin scene in the cell, and then Eccles when they join him. And I do love that gag, which is a bit of a time filler one, but it's one that they keep, variations of which they keep using, where there's actually two gags for the price of one earlier on. It's like Friar Balsam says, look up there, a high window with no bar in. And Neddy says, curse these licensing laws. And that's a gag in and of itself, obviously. And then Eccles says, wait, I got a license for climbing out of windows, which is like an extra, a sort of another layer on top of that gag, which I think is very Spike.
Yes.
And then you have them doing that whole section where they're standing on each other's shoulders so they can get up and reach this window. And rather than the usual one, the usual payoff to that is let's see them doing this on television. We get Wallace saying the feat now being performed is extremely dangerous and should only be done on radio by experienced idiots.
Mm. And like you say, they at the climax, they sing a variation of the Robin Hood theme.
Yeah.
And Harry, there's this slightly odd false ending where Harry interrupts the theme tune.
Yes.
To send Christmas greetings to all their overseas listeners.
Yeah. And on the record, he really cocks it up. It's not on the Goon Compendium, the volume 12 Goon Compendium version, but he makes a right cock up of it on the record version, and it was kept in, which I quite like, you know, because it's him stumbling over it and not getting his words quite right. So
I wonder as to why that was, why they kept it in, like because there's a definite fluff.
Yes.
And he blows a raspberry.
It's more natural. It's more natural, maybe. It runs more naturally. It doesn't sound quite so eggy. And also perhaps because they'd taken so much of the music out, it needed a bit of the album needed a bit of padding. I don't know, or that recording needed a bit of padding.
Stop! Please, we forgot. From all of us here, waist deep in the snow of Sherwood Forest, we send Christmas greetings to all the people waist deep in the snow of Canada, South Africa, Australia, and New Zealand. We also send greetings to all those chest deep in snow in the aforementioned countries. I'll do that again. Do you mind, Chisholm? We also send greetings to all those... I'll start again. Also send greetings... I'll start from the beginning. Shall I thank you? Stop! Oh, we forgot! From all of us here waist deep in the snow of Sherwood Forest, we send Christmas greetings to all the people waist deep in the snow of Canada, South Africa, Australia, and New Zealand. We also send greetings to all those chest deep in those countries. And a Merry Christmas to you all.
Oh.
The Moriarty and Grip Pipe relationship in Robin Hood is brilliant. And I love I love the little sequence where they're in the stagecoach.
Did you hear that, Moriarty? Ye golden splendor for ye Robin Hood.
Ye money. Ow. Ye ow. Ye gotta go ow.
You've got to go.
Oh, another record sold.
No, I'll. And ye archery contest.
That's what he said.
Moriarty, methinks me can gain me a gold splendor.
But how? We've got no contacts.
Please don't do that with your teeth out. Stop worrying, Moriarty. I've got a trump card up my sleeve.
And I've got newspaper in my boots.
Yes, well, you always were a snappy dresser, oh, weren't you? Come, Steaming Frank, pack the jam tins. You and I are going to take a coach ride through Sherwood Forest.
Oh, a little tata.
Yeah, those little bits of interchange are always great between those two. And it's funny because they are sort of, Britpipe and Moriarty are sort of relegated to a less involved role in the show than they would normally get, because normally, obviously, they would be the main villains, even by this point, or definitely by this point.
Mm.
They don't really get that in this, but yeah, they've got, it's a very nice, it's still very nice interplay, and the fact that they do keep on throwing in the owls as well is highly entertaining. There was just one other thing I thought that stuck out from all of the from Ye Bandit is that Ellington's number in that is framed,
yes.
Lieber and
yes.
Stoller, which is an interesting enough song in itself.
Mm.
But at the end of it, there's this little section, and I think he does an impression of Crumb.
Yes, semi-Henry impression, I put here.
Yeah, he's doing, he's sort of doing the judge. He's pretending he's being sentenced by a judge, and the judge is him giving it a nyep, 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 in a sort of Crumb-style mumbling, and he's doing it. Yeah. And I think that's a one-off and a one and only. I don't think that you ever hear. I can't ever remember Ray playing one of the named characters or doing an impression of one of the named characters at any other point. So that is a real one-off, and that stuck in my. That was one thing that leapt out at me from E-Bandit.
He's done voices.
Yeah, of course.
No, during songs, I want to say during songs when he's doing a bit of sort of scat singing or whatever, he's maybe tried to do mini at one point, perhaps.
Okay.
Might be wrong, but...
Yeah, I think maybe you're right.
Listeners, please write in.
Yes.
Framed, that Ray's version of Framed, take it or leave it. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. Weirdly, there's a version by Darts.
Oh, right, yeah.
Band Darts, who are the sort of rock and roll revivalists at the end of the 70s, beginning of the 80s, and which is where I'd knew that song from. But yeah, it's a bit of a nothing really, Ray's version. It's a lot of spoken stuff and then a kind of slightly over the top chorus. One of my favourite of his performances, but that bit at the end with his Henry impression makes it really interesting.
Prisoner will stand to receive sentence!
Case? I'm dismissed! Well, good morning, Judge, and bless your heart.
Rita Hayworth in Ye Bandit, there's a line, another topical line that Blue Bottle makes to Rita Hayworth and her husbands.
Oh, yeah.
And I checked and she was on to her fourth husband as this was going on.
Yeah, she didn't mess about.
And she'd been married to Orson Welles previously. I didn't realise that.
No, nor did I.
Right. Question.
Mm.
Can one still, should one need a liquid decongestant, can one still purchase Friar's Balsam these days? Do you know?
I don't think you can. I think it would be something like, I suppose the only equivalent would be something like, something that you put in a tub of boiling hot water, like, you know, and breathe in like Vicks or Olbass oil.
What's that oil called?
Olbass oil, yeah. I mean, I think it's, you instinctive. I think if you were from here, and I don't know about you, I don't know about you folks in the Commonwealth, but in here, if you were from here, I think you would have instinctively have, you know, even my age, sort of being born, you know, well after this was broadcast, I kind of knew what it was, and I knew where the joke comes from, and I think it comes up a couple of other times, you know, for the name, either the name or the a gag related to the fact that it's Friars comes up in another couple of times in the Goon Show, and I sort of inherently understood what it was. I kind of knew what it was without needing to look it up or anything like that. But if you were coming to this, you know, as a sort of 30 something, you'd probably be baffled by that. I don't know. I'm going to have to look that up now.
Okay.
And the only other thing to say really was, as I say, it's a slightly weak ending, or a weaker ending. The sheriff kind of gets his way. He gets his 1,000 gold splendors and his piece of holly. And then the chaps just kind of leave. But other than that, the delivery, the gags are crisper. There's some more interesting gags in there.
Yes.
There's no extraneous, you know, the extraneous cast members, you know, really add to the thing, not detract from it. It's if you haven't heard it yet, you really should track it down. I do think it, as for a first listen, certainly it's a really strong, you know, there's not much in it that's weak. It's a really strong show.
There's also on the Goon Show compendium as an extra, there's a recording of a retake that Dennis and Valentine had to do.
Oh, yes.
You hear Wallace kind of joshing with producer Pat Dixon as they're about to re-record, and it's quite interesting.
All right, Pat, relax.
You relax, you blew the mic.
That was the idea. Wake up old Bobby J.
All right, we're running. Any time, give a 10-second cue and do them with a 2-second gap between them, will you please?
Doesn't affect you at all. Look, if you just do the first one first, Dennis.
Thank you, Dean.
Nine first. Do nine first.
Okay.
Then leave, say, a couple of seconds pause before you go on to the next one. All right?
Yes.
So they can start it in. All right, recording room. What there, Seeker, please. All right, recording room. We'll go off with these two retakes.
No, please, I told you, no more jokes like that. We give in your bad jokes. Thuns, thuds, blats, wallops, pluns, blins, and zoes were far larger than ours.
Yes, but we were better on the bonks, bangs, and kaluds.
But we had so few of them.
All right. Well, there it is, ladies and gentlemen. Good night to you all, and thank you very much for coming along. Good night.
Yeah, so, Chaz, I think we've done very well, I think, to flip between the chief two shows and also refer back to the 52 series 3
and talk
about
the guests, and that's well without even really talking about Carol Carr, but yes, we've covered a lot of ground, haven't we?
So thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
I try to be as researched and prepared as much as I can, and you're more prepared than me, I think. So
I don't know about that, but I find it all the little kind of asides and the bits and pieces, and the, you know, why has he said that, and why has this person been cast, and you know, I do like sort of delving into it all, so it's always a pleasure to come on and chat to someone who's similarly nerdy.
Yes, well, even though this episode of Goon Pod is going out in April, in the spirit of these two shows, I want to wish you a very Merry Christmas, Chaz.
Thank you very much, and to all those chest deep in the snow.